Thank you for that introduction. So I have no relationship to disclose. So the title of my talk is actually a little different than what's in the program. We're calling it India's Success in Family Planning is Reducing Family Size Enough. I worked with my mentor, Professor Judy Lewis, also at UConn, and Dr. Shakuntala Chhabra of Mahatma Gandhi Institute of Medical Sciences. So India has had a long history of family planning practices. In 1970, the National Family Planning Program was established and population targets were set. This program has been very successful. Family size has reduced significantly since it was established. However, some of the methods used to get to this point have been less than optimal. There's been widespread coercion and reproductive abuses, especially of the rural and poor populations. Even now, there's a huge pressure for female sterilization, and it continues to be a problem. Vasectomies, funnily, have a stigma associated with them, so they have fallen out of favor. The National Family Health Survey is a large multi-round study done in India pretty regularly, and we took some data from 2005-2006, and at the time the current family size was 2 to 3 children, so relatively small. These programs are working. However, we note that there's at least almost one male in every family, so there is a some preference. Female sterilization is often the first and only family planning method used by women. The contraceptive prevalence rate is relatively low at 56%. 66% of those women reported female sterilization as the method that they use, and 81% of those women were sterilized by age 30. So, why is the lack of family planning and birth spacing important? In India, 200 women die per 100,000 births, and 56 of 1,000 children die before age 5. In the tribal areas of India, this is even worse. Under 5 mortality jumps to 96 out of 1,000 births. So the Millennium Development Goals 4 and 5 were not met in India, and we really need to talk about why they weren't. So family planning isn't just about size. Short birth intervals are also bad for mothers and children. Anything before 36 months can increase maternal death and morbidity as well as child death and morbidity. And also greater than 60 months can increase the risk of preeclampsia. So why do we want to look at this in India? So if you look at this map, India is colored black, which means that over 40% of children experience malnutrition. Anemia and malnutrition have been associated with short interpregnancy intervals. So this is definitely an important conversation we need to have. And this is even worse in the marginalized areas of this country. So during the summer, between my first and second year of medical school, I traveled to Melghat, which is a remote tribal area in Maharashtra. It's in the little yellow part that's labeled over there. So in Melghat, about 56% of births occur at home. In 2012, the Mahatma Gandhi Institute of Medical Sciences worked with an existing hospital in the area to build the Uthavali Mother and Child Hospital. The school also provides field visits to provide care to the villages and the surrounding area, and they do work with community health workers that are also established there. The hospital was built to provide safe deliveries, C-sections, blood transfusions to the women in this area. However, utilization of their services has been relatively low, and they wanted to figure out how to better interact with the community, how to make sure that these women were coming in, and if they needed something that the hospital was not providing. So I just wanted to show you a few pictures of some of the women you might run into in Melghat. So on the left, you're going to see a grandmother. She's probably only in her late 50s. She's worked very hard her entire life on the farm, and now she's the head of the household, and whatever she says goes. And the girl on the right, she's only 9. She's carrying pots that are going to be filled with water, and this is the family's daily water consumption. This is what they use. And if you look in the background, there's a very steep hill. The communal water pump for the entire village is located down there. So every day, she or someone in her family, usually a woman, has to go get the water. And this actually is pretty dangerous depending on weather conditions, and women have died trying to get water from the communal water pump. So the aims of our study were to explore the factors that influence women's willingness to use family planning. We also wanted to identify resources for education regarding family planning that already existed and understand the beliefs and culture of pregnancy and childbirth. So we created a survey that was largely adapted from the National Family Health Survey as well as the district level household and facility survey, two very commonly used surveys in India. We also did group interviews to assess cultural beliefs, learn about the methods of contraception used regularly, where women deliver, and the knowledge and availability of procedures at the hospital. Our survey was given as an individual questionnaire to understand demographic information, reproductive histories, assess any pertinent health risks and behaviors, and willingness to use family planning. So the survey was administered in Hindi with the use of a translator, and we talked to 117 tribal women that were married ages 18 through 49. We recruited them both in our field visits and also at the hospital. So if we look at some general statistics of the women we talked to, the mean age was about 27 years, so relatively young population that we spoke with. The mean education is low at 6 years, but the husband's is also pretty low as well at 7. The mean household number is about 6 people in a house, and 55% lived with their mother-in-law, which is actually lower than we anticipated. We expected there to be more of a relationship with the mother-in-law. The mean number of children is surprisingly, and I guess pleasantly surprisingly, low at 1.92. However, if you look at the mean number of sons, it is a little over one, so there is, again, that son preference. And at the time of our study, 28% of the women we spoke with were pregnant. So a little more information about what these women's lives are like. So if you look at the picture on the top right, this is the Anganwadi. So the Anganwadi translates to the nursery. So the Anganwadi worker is a government worker. She lives there. She's paid a salary to work there. Sometimes there may be more than one, depending on the size of the village. But she provides a wealth of services, or is supposed to provide these services. These include prenatal care and checkups, vaccinations for newborn children. There's also a midday meal program that's run by the government to help fight malnutrition. She also takes care of that. So she's kind of a one-stop shop. So she's a huge resource in the community, and we need to make sure that she has what she needs to do her work. The picture on the top left is a few children leaving school to actually go to the midday meal program, because this is often their only meal of the day. On the bottom left, you'll see just a picture of the terrain. So it's a beautiful time in the monsoon, but it can be very dangerous. It's forested and hilly, which can leave isolated pockets of the population, which is why they often can't receive health care. So on the bottom right, this is me talking to one of the families where I interviewed the mother that's in the picture. And this is a house that's considered pukka, which it means it's like a cement house, so it's a sturdy house. So the family is a little better off than some of the others we spoke with. So some of the results from our study that were most important, one is prevalence of sterilization. Again, we just showcased that if you look at currently used methods of 84 women who are currently using a method, female sterilization is by and far the most popular. 52% of the women we spoke with were sterilized by age 22. So the legal age for marriage technically is 18, so that means they got married, had 2 kids, had 1 son, and they're done, sterilized. 69% of the women with 2 or more children are sterilized. So reproductive health education is something we wanted to focus on as well. So again, like I said earlier, the Anganwadis are supposed to provide some counseling and provide services and also dispense oral contraceptives or condoms if they have them on hand. They are usually the women who educate these women. Sometimes they get information from their mothers or sisters, but a lot of that rests on their shoulders. So this is me with one of the doctors who is translating and a group of women we were speaking with. And again, you'll see some of the houses they live in back there. So this is a general idea of family planning in the population. So this is the same chart I had earlier with the current youth, and now we're comparing to knowledge of a method and also ever use. So now this is including the entire set of women we spoke with. So again, female sterilization is the winner with knowledge, ever use, and current use. But we were really excited to see that knowledge of method was pretty high for more than just female sterilization. Condoms, oral contraceptives, IUDs were all pretty well known, which showed us that they were learning about it either from the Anganwadi, from their family, from TV or advertisements, but there was some gap between knowledge and actual use. When we talked to them, we tried to ask, you know, is it your mother-in-law that's stopping you? Is it your husband? Is there some barrier that way? And their opinion is actually not as important, and many of them didn't even discuss it with their mother-in-law, so we couldn't really use that as a hypothesis. However, we did find out that there is a belief that using oral contraceptives for more than a few months at a time is injurious to health, as they believed that the hormones would cause bad side effects, infertility, etc., and so they didn't want to deal with that. Condoms, again, hinge on the use, the partner willing to use it, so that requires education of the husband, etc. And IUDs would require you to go and get it implanted somewhere, and many of these women don't have access to do that. So education was also an important factor we found in our study. So the role of education was important, so it's positively correlated with fewer children, with wealth, which we kind of figured out through what the families had, such as like TV, electricity, etc. It was also positively correlated with the use of reversible methods of contraception. And again, reversible methods of contraception are extremely important for birth spacing. However, education was not related to son preference. So no matter what, these families wanted at least one son. And finally, birth spacing was something we learned about in this community. This actually wasn't something we were intending on studying, but when we looked at our data, we were really surprised. We asked the women what they thought would be the optimal spacing between children, and on average, it was 29 months. So this is lower than that recommendation of 36. And if you look at the actual data, 72% of the first birth spacing intervals were below 36 months, on average 27.8. If you look at all the intervals, so this would be if a woman, let's say if some woman had five children. We had women who had even more, but there were so few of them, we didn't include them. They all fall below 36, so this definitely is an issue. So some conclusions from our study, female sterilization is the dominant method. Birth spacing is too short for maternal and child health and well-being. The health workers are not promoting birth spacing. So these healthcare workers are financially incentivized to promote and make sure these women are sterilized. The women also get some compensation, but it's not enough to make them do this. So they're definitely pushed into this by the cultural idea and by the people around them. So we need to find a way to make sure that these healthcare workers are also promoting the use of reversible methods and pushing for birth spacing. We also need comprehensive education and involvement of the husband. So some recommendations we have, the hospital and any NGOs that want to work in this area should try and find interventions and use them at important points in women's lives. So this is when they get married, this is prenatal counseling, this is postnatal counseling and vaccination time after their first child. We also recommend incentives for community health care workers to teach about birth spacing specifically. Also work with men to promote family planning, and they actually are working on the study right now over there. And future research could be couples birth spacing knowledge and beliefs, and see maybe is the husband influencing that at all. So is reducing family size enough? No, birth spacing is also important. India has come very far in their family planning efforts. However, birth spacing has to now be a major part to end preventable maternal and child health. So I just wanted to thank you all for being here, and I wanted to acknowledge the University of Connecticut School of Medicine for their funding, for my mentor, Judy Lewis, who unfortunately could not be here last minute. Thank you.
Thank you so much, speaker, for their wonderful presentation. So this is time for Q&A. If you have questions for any of them, you may now ask your questions. Yes.
Thanks. Great question, and I'm glad you enjoyed the presentation. So in terms of your first point about ultrasounds, we actually have a second study that should be coming out shortly, where we did, I didn't explain how our clinics were structured. So moms would come, so we have a general medical dental clinic that was set up in these rural villages, and in parallel to that ran a maternal health clinic. And so moms would present directly to the separate maternal health clinic, kind of like the labor and delivery ward in the hospital, where moms go straight there, check in. They would be consented, given our entrance survey, and then after that they would go over and have a midwife exam. And so a registered Ugandan midwife would do typical palpations, feel the belly. They would actually write down what they thought the gestational age was and position of the baby. Then the moms would go over for blood testing. We did HIV, malaria, hepatitis B, syphilis. And then they would come back. They would get the ultrasound scan. Then they would talk to, we had a family planning session afterwards for all the women as well. And then they would get an exit survey asking them how they felt, and we would review the results with them about everything, the tests, ultrasound, et cetera. So the midwife exam happened before the ultrasound, and they were sort of blinded to it. It was interesting that the ultrasound picked up numerous presentations of breech pregnancies, twins, oligohydramnios, that were not picked up on the midwife exam, so we found clear evidence that ultrasound in and of itself is really useful, which we know from maternal health here in North America. Every woman gets an ultrasound, two ultrasounds during her pregnancy. And then the second part of your question again was, can you remind me? Right, so we actually, we purchased two machines. We got a global health grant through Fujifilm Sonosight, and then we left those ultrasound machines on long-term lease with our local partner in Uganda. So they've been there for the last 2 years now, and they actually started a maternal health clinic. So they run that once a month, and basically once a week, I should say, they see 40 women every week for the last 2 years using ultrasounds. So they're highly sustainable. And actually, one of the machines broke. In the study, we had two of them, and someone dropped it out of the van, and it cracked the screen. So we were able to get it to a repair site in Kenya, and then they fixed it for us and sent it back to Uganda. So yeah, I would say it's very sustainable.
Any other questions?
So you mean the staff to run the entire program, or? Yeah, so our model with Bridge to Health is close hand-in-hand partnership with local healthcare organizations. So I see our work as basically just to assist the local group. So Kigizi Healthcare Foundation has been around for 15 years. So they run their own programs, and we just kind of support them. So they've been responsible for recruiting all of their own local staff, training them, and they hire members of the community, basically. And they're affiliated with the government, and they send some of their staff for additional training, family planning, and then they've brought in their own certified ultrasound technicians who they've been able to retain, even though they make about a tenth of what they would make in a private setting. Yeah. So it's our local partner, I guess, is the answer.
I actually had a question for Dr. Alonso. Two questions, actually. So my first question is, so you asked the women, or the Miss School would ask the women if they're trying to measure the tolerance for domestic violence of white beating. Is that then a proxy for the experience of domestic violence? That's my first question. And the second question is really around the issue of autonomy. But did you consider, was there any question in the midst that examined autonomy? Because I'm thinking that it must have something to do with your response or your outcome variable. So that if you were talking to women that were mainly very autonomous, you might have something different in terms of your results. So did you consider autonomy at all?
So first to answer the second question, unfortunately, autonomy was not measured in the MIG survey, and that's one of the limitations of that study. And but for the first question, the attitude towards domestic violence being a proxy for the experience of violence, in a way, it isn't really a good proxy for the experience of domestic violence. However, research has shown very strong correlations between tolerance of domestic violence, particularly physical violence, tolerance attitudes for wife beating with the experience of physical violence. But again, it's not a very strong proxy for the experience of domestic violence. And we decided to focus on the attitude because we were using a model, the health belief model, which deals mainly with perceptions, feeling that that could probably be a way to understand how women view violence, particularly for the reason that women are more tolerant of violence than men. And in studies that have looked at both male and female responses, in some countries, men are probably like 20 percentage points less even, you know, likely to feel that it is okay compared with women. So we were basically focusing on women's factors and trying to understand that through the lens of the health belief model.
Question. I have one for you, Michael. So one of the questions that I had for you was around the ultrasound. So do you have plans of kind of taking the same kind of research to other countries? And I ask this because I know that, you know, if women want to come for antenatal care because of, you know, the fact that they get to see a picture of their unborn child, that also increases, you know, attendance generally. And also that is linked to skilled birth attendance. So it means that many people were going to be going to the health centers to get, you know, to deliver their children. And so that's kind of linking them to healthcare in a way. So I'm curious to know if you have, you know, if there are other studies or other countries that have adopted or are planning to adopt what you have just explained, and or if you have intentions of taking it somewhere else.
Yes, thank you. So that was the whole point of us doing the study, actually, was to try to encourage. I see the sort of the work that we were doing as advocacy and implementation work almost, and so the purpose was to provide tools to then go and take it back to ministries of health and suggest that ultrasound is clearly an important, necessary tool that you should be implementing with your antenatal care services. So we're just about to we're submitting the paper that we put together for publication now, and then we'll hopefully use that to try to lobby a little bit, change policy. That would be the goal, yeah.
One last question for you, Ponja and Tazi. So in all of your presentation, I'm curious to know what the role of the men were. Like, did the women talk about their husbands, their partners, and what were their roles? What did they say that was, you know, the partner's roles in the decision to whether to use contraceptives or, in your case, Tazi, to, you know, as it relates to your outcome, so.
So to do our study, we generally had to make sure that the women were alone so that they would disclose some of the sensitive information. So we didn't actually get to talk to many men. However, they do talk about their husbands. They don't really have control over when they're engaging in sexual intercourse. So, you know, we need to try and make sure that these women have something that they can kind of like protect themselves with, which is also why sterilization has become popular, because if a woman can't say no, at least she has that to fall back on. Also, the men, like, they don't want to use condoms, that's an issue, and generally if they find out that their wife is using some method, then they wonder why they're doing that, or they think that it's bad for her health or their children. So they sometimes do say no, but that is where the education piece came in to be important, because if the male was more educated, he generally was more lenient or allowing of her to use a method other than sterilization, or even he got a vasectomy, which was not that common. our study, we may look at for the women, especially women respondents. But for the men, we all have the social demographic federal education, the occupation. And yes, education is highly related to the using the labor attendant at the pregnancy, at the time of the pregnancy and the delivery. But we mainly focus on the women in this study, so we don't include the men. Social demographic federal.
I'll also give a round of applause to our presenters. Thank you so much.